Hi, this is John Udell. My guest for this week's podcast is Dr. John Halumka. He's truly a renaissance guy. He's a physician, a CIO for multiple organizations, and a healthcare IT innovator who's been doing service-oriented architecture since long before we called it that. Lots of people are talking about secure exchange of medical records and portable continuity of care documents. Dr. Halumka is on the front lines actually making these visions real.
Hello.
Hello, John. How are you doing?
Good.
Thanks for agreeing to do this.
Oh, certainly. Now, my recollection is that this is a podcast or something you're going to record.
Yeah, that's the idea. So I'll record this and then edit it down to just the coherent bits.
Well, let's hope it's all coherent. Usually what I'll do is, you know, you meet with Dan Rather or Tom Brokaw for 2 hours, and then you're reduced to, it's cool, it's neat, you know, it's 12 seconds of airtime.
So right. No, these usually run quite long, but they are condensed down from raw material, which is always somewhat longer.
There you go.
A lot of what I'm doing is removing the incoherence on my side because I have a tendency to wander. But in general, I like to think of it as kind of the NPR style, which is just to make everything sound really, really good.
Sure.
So in any event, you are a guy with more titles than anyone I know. but the context in which I thought to have this conversation was the one in which you are the chairman of the New England Health Electronic Data Interchange Network.
Okay.
Which is a mouthful. And do you have a way of pronouncing the...
NEHIN.
You say NEHIN? Okay.
Exactly.
And it was the NEHIN initiative that you described in your keynote that you gave at InfoWorld's SOA conference. And
right.
I was describing what you had said to someone else and saying a few things about what you had indicated was in development in terms of secure exchange of medical records on that network.
Absolutely.
And the guy said, wow, that sounds really interesting. I wonder how they're doing it. And I said, I've been meaning to follow up and kind of drill down on that as well. So,
and the answer is everything is a service-oriented architecture. Shock.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but that's not the end of the story.
Of course.
It's a good lead-in, though. So it's a pretty daunting set of challenges, right? I mean, here is information which, on the one hand, if it doesn't get where it's going in a timely fashion, will result in dire consequences. And on the other hand, if it happens to leak along the way will also result in dire consequences. And there are all kinds of stakeholders with all kinds of controls that they want to put on the process. And by and large, it a lot of time just hasn't really happened much at all. But I know that you're deeply engaged in making it possible for that to happen more often and more securely and more rapidly. And I just want to kind of have you walk through from two perspectives. One, an architecture that those of us who are technical can relate to, but
sure,
maybe as well, it would be good if we can find some way to explain what's happening here to people who are less technical, but who will nevertheless be able to appreciate why they should trust this working well and working properly.
Good. Well, certainly happy to address those thoughts.
Okay.
So in 1997, we first started community-wide data exchange with financial data. The basics of, are you eligible for care? Getting a referral, getting a bill from a provider to a payer, getting paid. Now, if you ask, of course, what is the controversy, should, oh my God, it be leaked that, yes, you have Blue Cross insurance? Not very controversial. If, on the other hand, if it's leaked that you have HIV, mental health issues, or a substance abuse problem, this could be career-limiting, it could threaten family stability, it could have devastating consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's an interesting challenge. Yes, you want to move forward with something that creates interoperable health care, which we hope will improve the quality of care, but you don't want to inappropriately exchange data in any way that could be compromising to a patient's well-being. So we started in 97 with a service-oriented architecture idea that we wouldn't have a central database of anything.
Mm-hmm.
That is, a doctor's office wouldn't have any kind of persistent data store. An insurance company would have just a persistent data store about its individual members, I guess you'd call them, people who are covered. But it, you know, as a community, what you'd do is you'd say, oh, doctor's offices will do transient, web-based but secure transactions the moment they need to know. Okay, is John Halumka eligible for care at Blue Cross? Yes. And that transaction took place over the Internet securely between two parties, but it wasn't persisted in any kind of third-party database. So in a sense, there's nothing to hack at the center.
So this was an outcome of an architectural choice to prevent, for example, the doctors from storing this information permanently, or just there was no provision that made it easier for them to do that, so they just tended not to?
It answered a couple of requirements. First, you ideally don't want to persist a lot of data into a central database where it could be compromised or leaked. You also want something that is very updated. That is, we know that moments after data is collected, it can become obsolete.
Mm-hmm.
And so hence, if you say everything is messaging middleware, at the point a clinician needs to know something about you, instantly the source of truth is queried and the clinician can then get that response.
Mm-hmm.
It's both accurate, it's timely, and it's secure because you aren't, a hacker trying to hack into, let's say, a piece of fiber to grab a single transaction as it flies over the wire. Possible? Yeah, real unlikely. So it was also easily created low cost. You didn't have to build a data center to do this because, in a sense, it's like Napster. You know, it's peer-to-peer from place to place. It's middleware between existing systems and no new systems per se.
Right, which means the vulnerabilities that exist are only the ones that already were there. There can still be a social engineering attack at the source of truth or at, on the other hand, the requester's physical premises and so on. But that's always true in every case, no matter how it's done. So
yeah, it made the security no worse than it already was.
Right.
So then we fast forward to 2006, where we say, oh, we've got this rich experience of nearly a decade of this peer-to-peer messaging middleware idea. What about clinical data?
Mm-hmm.
And we started asking questions like, oh, do you send psychiatric notes? Do you send, you know, issues that might involve disclosure of specific illnesses that may have social stigma? You know, the one thing we can probably all agree is e-prescribing. That is, what medicines are you on? How do I message securely from a doctor's office to a pharmacy so that you are put on an accurate medication? How do we make sure that that medication is paid for? Very simple messaging middleware, in fact, analogous to the way we did financial transactions 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
No central database.
Mm-hmm.
Doctor goes to write a prescription. First, we say, does this patient have coverage? Oh, yes, they have coverage. Well, then is the medication they want on the formulary of the payer? You know, this particular medication is advertised on television, very expensive, not on the formulary. But here's one that's just as good. Messaging middleware from that payer comes back to the doctor saying, here are the alternatives, and patient, here are the copays, here are your choices, you decide. Then once the patient makes the decision, off to CVS, Osco, Brooks, Savon, whatever pharmacy you want the prescription delivered to electronically, and there's no handwriting, no transcribing, no errors that might occur. So it's end-to-end, secure, encrypted, and accurate from the doctor's brain to the patient's vein. And that, again, seemed like a very good opportunity to improve care in a way that people would accept without having to re-engineer a lot of existing systems.
And in a way that might be apparent to most people is going to tend to be more secure and more accurate than the de facto situation we have now, which is telephone calls and people scribbling things down.
Right? Or even worse. So let me give you an example. When I was a resident in emergency medicine, one of my colleagues left his little rubber stamp that happens to have a signature and a drug enforcement agency number on it, just sitting in the doctor's lounge. And often doctors will stamp these handwritten prescriptions.
Mm-hmm.
And he got a call the next day saying, you know, Dr. Smith, did you really order 250,000 prescriptions of Vicodin? And, you know, that's the challenge here is that we have worked in a world of paper and fax machines and rubber stamps, and now we're working in an end-to-end, fully encrypted, fully audited world where security is much easier to enforce.
So can you give people a sense of, for the financial stuff, which has been happening relatively longer, and the prescribing, which has been happening relatively more recently, what the extent of the network is that's involved here in terms of pharmacies and physicians and hospitals?
Sure. Well, back in 1997, we started with some basic transactions just so doctors could ask, hey, insurance company, is this patient covered? Today, we're doing 150 million transactions a year, covering 90% of the financial exchange in the state of Massachusetts.
Okay.
So this is big. And it's all done, by the way, in a collaborative way. There are no fees that are paid, no transaction fees or click fees that we think would be friction to commerce. It's just 42 major insurance companies and major healthcare organizations all came together to build this thing, and we pay some membership dollars to keep the thing afloat, but we don't actually have any fees for transactions.
Mm-hmm.
On the e-prescribing side, we've been doing that for about 6 months now, and today we have 85% of the pharmacies in the state of Massachusetts connected. And we're doing all the prescriptions from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. And so that's about 2,000 prescriptions a day currently.
Mm-hmm.
But we will be adding all of the prescriptions for Mass General, the Brigham and Women's, in the first quarter of 2007. And hopefully throughout 2007, 2008, we'll do the same kind of thing we did with financial transactions and get up to the point where, hey, we've got 90% of the transactions of the state, millions of prescriptions going through it.
Mm-hmm. Now, the scope of the network is wider than Massachusetts, right? You call it the New England network, and I think it does involve other states to some extent, right?
Sure. I mean, so we've done work in Connecticut and New Hampshire and Vermont. Massachusetts has been the core area we tend to work in simply because there's this wonderful collaboration that's occurred in Massachusetts. All nonprofit hospitals, all regional insurers, so we have Harvard Pilgrim, Blue Cross, and Tufts, Medicare and Medicaid, that are very tight in their region. So if people just sit together across the table and say, hey, you want to exchange data? Sure, I trust you.
Mm-hmm.
And take California, for example, where you've got 148 different insurers, no one owning more than 3% of the market, there's huge amounts of competition, not a lot of trust. So when you suddenly say, share data, oh my God, that'll break down proprietary barriers.
Mm.
How could we do that?
Have you begun to see any examples where these exchanges are occurring across state borders, like, say, from Massachusetts to Connecticut?
Yeah, I mean, currently our e-prescribing network does include Rhode Island and Connecticut and surrounding states. So we can send from a doctor's office to a pharmacy.
Mm-hmm.
But I will tell you that one of the challenges in doing, say, doctor-to-doctor or doctor-to-patient exchange across state borders is that HIPAA, our privacy law for the country, is preempted by state law.
Mm-hmm.
So that means we have totally different privacy laws across each state. And let me give you an example. It turns out that imagine you come to me, I'm a doctor, I'm an emergency physician, and say, hey, John, I give you complete consent to get all electronic records about me so you can deliver high-quality care.
Mm-hmm.
One place I might look is in the payer claims, that is, what medications, for example, were paid for. So that gives me a sense of what medications you're taking. In Massachusetts, it is illegal for a doctor, even with patient consent, to get a list of medications that include mental health, substance abuse, or HIV-related treatment. So wait a minute. If I'm in one state, I can't actually even get a complete list of medications the patient is taking
mm-hmm.
with their consent?
Mm-hmm.
But no such law exists in Rhode Island. No such law exists in Connecticut.
Okay.
So you have to, just as you do this, really be cognizant of the fact that there isn't a uniform privacy policy across all our states yet.
Okay. So let's take it just from the perspective of Massachusetts, where we're dealing with a single body of state law. What are the ways in which your system needs to demonstrate its compliance with HIPAA and the ways in which it needs to be auditable? And then what are the ways in which the permission givers are giving permission? Is that a one-time thing? Is that a per-transaction thing or something in between?
We believe in a federated trust relationship, and that means, gee, Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center probably knows who its trustworthy doctors are better than, say, some third-party state entity.
Yep.
So hence, we delegate to the individual hospital authorities to decide who is to be trusted, and they can grant and revoke that trust on a daily basis if they want. Gee, here is a doctor who is leaving the medical center. Trust is now revoked. And from a peer-to-peer perspective, when Beth Israel Deaconess communicates with a pharmacy, the pharmacist trusts Beth Israel Deaconess, and Beth Israel Deaconess trusts its doctors. Therefore, the pharmacist trusts the doctors.
And when you say that these entities trust one another, you mean that in the actual human sense, not in any kind of PKI and digital certificate sense, right?
I mean it in both.
Okay.
there is, of course, the policy from a HIPAA perspective that these are business entities that are business associates, therefore they've signed agreements that they trust each other in a formal legal sense. Mm-hmm. But the way that we deal with it technically is that we have a messaging gateway with a set of certificates so that, yes, this is a certificate that is used from Beth Israel Deaconess to communicate with SureScripts, RX Hub, or pharmacies directly. And that is done over HTTPS with a certificate exchange. So it's kind of a flavor of PKI of sorts. It's using SAML and SOAP.
From the, let's say, patient's perspective, if it's my information that's being traded around, how did I express the permission that I gave for that to happen?
From an e-prescribing standpoint, because this, in a sense, isn't directly sharing the information with, say, other doctors, there's simply a consent form that is signed when you register for care that we are going to be using electronic means in the provision of your treatment that will provide accurate and quality care. And so it's part of our general consent for treatment. Now, let me tell you that we are beginning a pilot in three communities in Brockton, Newburyport, and North Adams to really ask the question, well, what if doctors in a small community, that is, say, a primary caregiver and a specialist, could actually share data about you, how would you, the patient, feel about that?
Right.
So we developed a set of educational materials where for those three cities in that pilot, you have to read the educational materials, understand the risks and the benefits of data sharing, and then take a little multiple choice test. It's not like a typical consent where you don't read the fine print, you just sign your name and you're done. It's no, you have to specifically elect, yes, I agree to share data in the following circumstances between the following two doctors or two hospitals. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you the results so far is that 96% of the patients in those three communities have agreed to share data about themselves within the community. They feel comfortable about that.
Right. And this would be a one-time decision that they would make subject to changing their mind, but it wouldn't be a per-transaction approval.
And so it is what we would call an institution-level opt-in. Mm-hmm. So that means you go to a doctor's office and say, I, the patient, approve at this particular site of care for my data to be shared, but I can revoke it at any time.
Mm-hmm.
And you're correct. That once elected, you're not asked every single time you visit. But hey, it's up to you. If you want to sign one week and then unsign the next week, that's fine.
If the person wishes to review the flow of information that has occurred on their behalf, how would they go about doing that, or could they do that?
Yeah, we audit everything. And so examples at Beth Israel Deaconess, one of the things I've done for years is made the audit of all of our transactional systems available to the patients via the web. So you can actually see who saw what, when, and why.
Really? That's outstanding.
The challenge, I'll tell you, is that when you come into the hospital, about 30 different people look at your record.
Yep.
Why? Well, the dietitian has to know if you're a diabetic. The pharmacist, what medications that you're on. You know, the social worker wants to make sure you've got good mental well-being, et cetera, et cetera. So, boy, you got a care team of 30 people. So when you go home and you look at the audit trail, you're like, who was Dr. Smith? I don't remember Dr. Smith. Oh, that was the intern who was working for my attending.
That's fascinating. I'll bet that an extremely small percentage of people ever do avail themselves of the opportunity to look at that stuff. But it's, right? Is that true?
I'll tell you that we have several audits available, including one where employees can look to make sure that no other employees have looked at their records.
Right.
That one's actually used fairly frequently.
Right.
You know, I want to know, hey, you know, if my coworkers are peeking into my record, they're going to get fired. But a typical patient, you know, we have 40,000 patient users of this particular personal health record where this audit is available. And, you know, they run their security audits not so frequently. I mean, it's probably on the order of, out of 40,000 patients, maybe 10 patients a month run their security audit.
Right. Well, I guess part of it is it's not right now an expectation that most people have. I mean, it's one that they should have, but probably most don't expect that they even could do such a thing.
That's true. I mean, it is the notion of a patient being the steward of their own medical data, having access and control of it, is something that's very, very new.
Mm-hmm.
And I think something that's going to really be essential, because if we're going to overcome all of the arcane privacy laws we have in this country, there's a simple way to do it. Put the patient in control of everything.
Mm-hmm.
That way, you decide what to share, when, and with who.
suppose I am now about to move from Massachusetts to Oregon.
Yep.
Is there any way that we're close to me being able to instruct my healthcare system to disgorge some representation of what it knows about me such that I could take it as a package to my new location and present it to them?
On October 20th, I presented to Secretary Leavitt 12,000 hours of work by 261 organizations to define exactly what you just described.
Mm-hmm.
How do we create a continuity of care document which takes your medications, your demographics, your allergies, basics about your personal healthcare preferences like advanced directives or pregnancy status, other things, and allows you to take that in a transportable way from place to place.
Mm-hmm.
And so here that was presented to the secretary, accepted by the secretary, and now we're just working on the rollout time frame for this as a country. There is a public-private collaboration called the Commission for Certification of Healthcare Information Technology, and this commission will certify vendor products as being compliant with standards. And so now that we've done this standard, it will, in 2007, 2008, 2009, certify vendor products, and assuming that, hey, you need to have that level of interoperability to be certified, that vendors will start to incorporate it. And yes, it'll be a few years from now, but your notion of taking it from place to place with a single standard will be a reality.
The logistics of that could be that I get something physical that I transport, like it's on a DVD, or it could be that it's a pointer to something on the network with appropriate access controls. But either way, I mean, the underlying point here is that there's the agreement that it can happen, and then there's some notion about what standards would need to apply to the representation of that data.
Yeah, and the way that we have created this the standard, again called the Continuity of Care Document, is it's an XML document which has all of your clinical data, but then has metadata about who you are and the contents of the document, and it can be sent via the web through a SOAP transaction. It could be copied to a thumb drive.
Yep.
You know, it can be transported in a multitude of vehicles. In fact, we're even starting to talk to the folks at Adobe about how do you take such a piece of electronic data and metadata and put it into a PDF for transportation.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be both read and interpreted.
And what is the standards group that is concerned with the development of this?
The Healthcare Information Technology Standards Panel.
Okay.
www.hitsp.org is the national organization that includes all standards organizations, payers, providers, employers, privacy advocates, all working together for this single purpose.
The first question that comes to mind when there is any discussion of exchange of medical data on the network is security, and I think we've talked plenty about that. The flip side of that is kind of what are the opportunities that arise once this becomes more broadly possible? And one of them I'd be interested to hear your thoughts in is this whole notion about how we fail to be able to judge medical outcomes very effectively because we lack the data.
Correct.
To analyze them. Part of the motivation here is obviously just to be able to get the right medicines to the right people in time and not screw up. But there's also this dimension of, you know, how do we, with appropriate controls, analyze this body of information to do much better research on outcomes and hopefully produce better outcomes as a result of that, right?
Oh, well, absolutely. So one of the things Secretary Leavitt has been quite passionate about is transparency. Because imagine this. Let's say you need your gallbladder out. And how do you know where to go? Well, let's see. You know, Dr. X, he does 20,000 of these a year, charges $1,000, and everybody goes back to work the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Y, well, he did 12 of them. He charges $5,000. Everybody got sick for a week. Who are you going to pick? Well, the answer today is you have no data.
Yes.
So the assumption is, one, doctors get electronic health records. Two, that you have standards that can report on outcomes and quality, and then that's broadly shared with the consumer. And this is exactly the kind of thing that we hope to do with data, is publish population measures, comparisons. And so one day, and hopefully in the not-too-distant future, you will effectively have a dashboard that will help you as a consumer decide where and how to get your care.
Yeah, it'll help me as a consumer, and some version of that will help you as a provider to analyze not only who was better at doing gallbladder procedures and who was worse, but in what circumstances, no matter who did it, it was the right or wrong thing to do.
Right. And I will tell you, a challenge in medicine is that doctors don't use a consistent vocabulary. So suppose that I say, oh, the patient had a fever. Well, what's a fever? Well, I can tell you the clinical definition is a temperature of greater than 101.5 degrees Fahrenheit for greater than 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
But when people say, I have a fever, sometimes it means I feel hot, or I was sweaty, mm-hmm. or, gee, you know, I feel a chill. And so here we have this challenge of how do I analyze outcomes or quality when the basic data we're gathering is pretty much unstructured free text, and everybody means something different when they say fever.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we talk about standards, we're not only talking about the standard to transmit something from place to place and to define how the data is structured, but also the underlying vocabulary so that you understand, hey, fever means something.
Right. So reaching these kinds of semantic agreements is obviously still going to be a challenge. It's just that when we start to get to the place where we're addressing that challenge because we're thinking in terms of putting together these, as you call it, continuity documents, it invites us to think a little more carefully about, well, what do we put in that document and how do we describe these things? And we start to reach for a common vocabulary because there's a reason to think about that where maybe before there wasn't so much of a reason. Is that kind of how it plays out?
That's exactly right. And so what HITSB has tried to do for empowerment of the consumer, we've defined the vocabulary for medications and for allergies and the basics of demographics and the structure of how to transmit it from place to place. And we're now working on a lot of the security layers on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
So privacy, absolutely foundational. You know, need to make sure that's in place. Policy is being made at a national level, and there's quite a lot of groups making sure that we can transmit data from place to place, state to state, and adhere to appropriate policy. So it's a lot of activity simultaneously, and you can hear the time frame is not 20 years from now, it's over the next couple of years.
If you think, and I think you do think in this case, that this is likely to be resolved sooner rather than later, but you know, given the experience that a lot of people have had in other domains where efforts to rigorously define taxonomies and ontologies and vocabularies have gotten pretty bogged down, how do you think you're going to get past that?
What HITSB has done is it has worked in a very compressed time frame. We were given the mandate from Secretary Leavitt in March, and as I said, in October delivered the finished product. So there was an urgency to do it. There was also a sense that perfection is the enemy of the good.
Mm-hmm.
And so we come up with a set of work that's good enough,
mm-hmm.
will be refined over time. And I think it's just a question of getting everybody to have their incentives aligned, to agree to work together, build a sense of urgency, and get it done. And that's what we did.
Outstanding. For people who are interested in following up on what we've talked about, the websites that you've named, I can cite in the introduction that I make to this. Are there other things that people should look at who are interested?
So HITSB.org, yep. www.hitsby.org is a very good one. And then just even looking at the activities of the health information community, Secretary Leavitt runs in a 17-member panel called the American Health Information Community, and if you just search on Google under the letters AHIC, A-H-I-C,
okay.
You will get the hhs.gov address for the American Health Information Community, which has a variety of streaming videos showing all of the latest and greatest that's going on at a national level about healthcare IT.
Outstanding. You're one of my favorite kind of can-do people, and I just am really glad to know that you're on the job doing this stuff, because I do have a feeling that, let's put it this way, you convinced me that it's going to happen sooner rather than later, and I so want that to be true.
Well, I'm a doctor, a patient, and a technologist, so I really do try to see it from each perspective.
Yeah, terrific. Thanks very much.
Absolutely, and if I can be of help in the future, just send me an email.
All right, thanks.
Talk to you later.